ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 29th of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. King Charles has addressed a joint session of the US Congress, only the second time a British monarch has done so. His late mother, Queen Elizabeth, delivered the last address in 1991. The King is visiting the US at a time when the relationship between the transatlantic allies is strained. Our America's editor, John Lyons, is in Washington. He joined me earlier. John, tell us about the King's speech.
Well, Melissa, I think there were three really key points there. The first one was the King talked about how the United Kingdom has committed to the biggest sustained increase in defence spending since the Cold War in order to be fit for the future. That's something the Americans have wanted from the UK and other NATO allies. So that will go down very, very well with the Trump administration. The second point, which President Trump won't like as much, was the King made a very strong defence of the NATO alliance and talked about how important it was going forward. And this protects the citizens and interests. It keeps North Americans and Europeans safe from common adversaries. We know President Trump's hostility to NATO. And so to have the King in the joint session of Congress giving a very strong and sustained defence of NATO was interesting. And thirdly, a very interesting reference to the AUKUS defence arrangement. The King said that the UK had agreed on the most ambitious submarine program in history, AUKUS in partnership with the US and Australia. And he said, Australia's a country of which I'm immensely proud to serve as sovereign. Let's hear what the King said about AUKUS.
We do not embark on these remarkable endeavours together out of sentiment. We do so because they build greater shared resilience for the future, so making our citizens safer for generations to come.
So, John, coinciding with the King's visit to Washington is a story that's been leaked about some comments made by the UK's ambassador to the US. Take me through those remarks.
The Financial Times has reported on a leaked or a recorded conversation that the UK ambassador to the US, Sir Christian Turner, had back in February with a group of school children when he obviously thought he was speaking privately, didn't realise it was being recorded and then would be leaked. And he's talking about that special relationship because, of course, the Americans and President Trump always talks about our special relationship with the US and vice versa. So does Sir Keir Starmer. Anyway, interesting to hear what the ambassador for the UK says when he doesn't think anybody's listening, except for a few school children. He said that he believes the only country with which the United States has a special relationship is probably Israel.
And John, Donald Trump and King Charles had a meeting in the Oval Office. Now, that wasn't open to the media, which is perhaps not entirely surprising. But why do you think that that was how they decided to proceed with the biggest moment of this visit, the direct talks between the two?
Well, we know how much President Trump likes to engage with the cameras and that Oval Office. He loves to have the leaders in there and be photographed with them and talk to them. Very interesting that today, clearly, they did not allow cameras anywhere near that. They did not allow journalists anywhere near the two of them. My own assessment is, for one reason, the ghost of Jeffrey Epstein. Both those men don't want to talk about Jeffrey Epstein for different reasons. King Charles doesn't want to talk about or be asked about Jeffrey Epstein, which he would have been, especially from the British media. We know the British media is a bit like the Australian media. They're pretty sort of full on and they don't tend to take a step back. King Charles doesn't want to talk about Jeffrey Epstein because his own brother Andrew, of course, and all his many connections with the whole Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking trafficking and sex abuse network. And we know that with Donald Trump, it's the one subject he least likes to talk about. The New York Times identified more than 5,300 files in all of the millions of Epstein files containing 38,000 references to Donald Trump, his wife, and the Mar-a-Lago resort, which he has down in Florida. Neither man wanted to talk about Jeffrey Epstein, and in my assessment, that's the reason it was sealed off from the media.
John Lyons in Washington there. The fallout from Jeffrey Epstein's connections being exposed continues to reverberate through politics on both sides of the Atlantic. The UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer's career is under threat because of questions about his appointment of Peter Mandelson as US ambassador, who had to resign after the extent of his links with the deceased sexual predator were revealed. Now, Keir Starmer's former chief of staff has fronted a parliamentary hearing to explain how that appointment happened. Europe correspondent Elias Kluwer reports from London.
Thank you for inviting me to appear before this committee.
The UK Prime Minister's former chief of staff took the witness stand in a parliamentary probe into the ambassadorial appointment that threatens to bring down a government.
The appointment of Mandelson as ambassador was a serious error of judgment. I advised the Prime Minister in support of that appointment, and I was wrong to do so.
That's the voice of Morgan McSweeney, who, as well as being Sir Keir Starmer's former Chief of Staff, was a key driver behind the PM's decision to appoint Peter Mandelson to the role of US Ambassador in early 2025, despite Mandelson's known connections to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
The reason why I thought he was the right choice is because Britain was exposed, the UK was exposed after Brexit. We left the European Union without any US trade deal. And I thought that based on Mandelson's experience as an EU trade commissioner, that made him the strongest candidate.
When it was revealed that Peter Mandelson had extensive contact with Epstein, including after the financier was convicted of sex offences, McSweeney resigned. He told the parliamentary committee that he and his boss, Sir Keir, were misled.
When I saw the pictures, when I saw the Bloomberg questions, I have to say it was like a knife through my soul.
The Mandelson appointment has created political peril for Sir Keir Starmer. 2 weeks ago, it was revealed that Peter Mandelson had failed a highly confidential vetting process, and at least two senior bureaucrats have now claimed the Foreign Office was under pressure to finalise the appointment of the controversial new ambassador as quickly as possible. Sir Keir has maintained that he did not know Mr. Mandelson had failed vetting clearance and that he never pressured the Foreign Office to speed up its processes. But the opposition wants an investigation into the Prime Minister, and on Tuesday it led a debate on whether Sir Keir had deliberately misled the Parliament when discussing Mandelson's appointment. His Conservatives leader, Cammie Badenoch, addressing the House of Commons.
We have been told that Number 10 put constant pressure on the Foreign Office to approve the application. That is not due process. The normal order is vetting and then announcement. But in this case, the announcement was before the vetting. That is not due process.
A subsequent vote on whether Sir Keir would be referred to the Parliament's Privileges Committee failed. But pundits say the political damage may already be done and the Prime Minister's fate could be terminal. As for Peter Mandelson, he continues to deny any wrongdoing. This is Elias Kluwer in London, reporting for AM.
The United Arab Emirates has announced it's pulling out of OPEC, the oil-producing nation's cartel, in the middle of the global energy crisis fueled by the US and Israel's war in Iran. The country says it wants greater flexibility to make calls about its oil industry on its own terms, but the decision adds to uncertainty in the region. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran is in Jerusalem. Matt, can you take me through the significance of the UAE's move here?
Mel, good morning. There are a couple of factors at play here. Firstly, the heft of the UAE as an oil-producing country. It's one of the largest in OPEC, the largest being Saudi Arabia. And the decision to pull out of OPEC means that the cartel's power is diluted somewhat in its ability to set oil production caps and oil prices across its membership there. More broadly, there is also a regional politics play here as well. For some time, but certainly highlighted lately, there has been tension between the UAE and Saudi Arabia on regional affairs in the Middle East. Everything from the war in Yemen through to the US and Israel's war with Iran. The UAE, for example, had been pushing Gulf states to take a much more firm position against Iran as Tehran launched hundreds of missiles and drones at its Gulf neighbours in retaliation for US and Israeli strikes. It wanted there to be significant damage to Iran's missile capability, given its proximity to Iran. But Saudi Arabia had been reportedly pushing for a deal to end the war, looking for regional stability as its priority. Then, when you take into account the impact of the war itself, there, of course, had been significant damage to oil infrastructure across the region. Refineries, depots, ports, and pipelines were all hit by Iran throughout the course of that war. That impacted production. And that's even before you look at the flow-on effects from the Iranian chokehold on the Strait of Hormuz, stopping those exports that, or those barrels of oil that were available for export, going out to key markets and sending prices surging around the world. Combine that with the suggestion that the UAE is getting closer to Israel. We learnt this week that Israel had deployed its Iron Dome air defences to the UAE, and the suggestion it's also getting closer with the United States. And Donald Trump has previously criticised OPEC for keeping oil prices high, and you do have something of a shopping list of factors which have led to this decision. The UAE says it's made this announcement in its own national interest. It wants more flexibility to deal with the post-war energy market, but in making a decision off its own bat, it could have significant flow-on effects.
And Matt, has there been any movement on a deal to try and reopen the Strait of Hormuz, given all of these consequences we're seeing as a result of it being closed?
Not really, although the US president has issued another post on his social media platform, Truth Social, on that issue in the last couple of hours or so. He says Iran has told his team that the country is in total chaos and that Tehran wants to reopen the strait as far as it's controlling it as soon as possible. Now, we do need to keep in mind, the US president has made multiple comments about the likelihood of a deal for weeks now, talking up the prospects of an agreement and talking down the stability of the Iranian regime at multiple junctures, and we haven't seen movement. And it was over the weekend that he cancelled a trip by his own negotiators to the Pakistani capital, Islamabad, effectively accusing Iran of not being serious in making a deal. In recent days, we've also seen Iran describing the chances of an agreement as slim, accusing the US of making excessive demands, among other things. Although it had been reported that it had proposed reopening the strait, Iran had proposed reopening the strait, both from its side and demanding the US lift its blockade of ports and ships in exchange for an end to the war and a commitment to negotiate further on Tehran's nuclear ambitions at a later point. But that latter issue around the nuclear program, that is something of a red line for the US here.
Matthew Doran in Jerusalem. Uncertainty about global fuel supplies is driving the federal government's budget decisions. The budget will be handed down in 2 weeks' time. The Prime Minister says it will be his government's most important and ambitious. Political reporter Evelyn Manfield has more.
As he talks fuel security,
we've got 44 days of petrol, 33 days of diesel and 30 days of jet fuel.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is facing questions about what measures could feature in the federal budget to boost the country's fuel reserves.
Our federal budget will be on May 12. I encourage you to attend.
While the PM might not want to talk about it pre-budget, others are happy to, including the opposition, who yesterday laid out its plan to reach 60 days' worth of supplies by 2030.
There is an argument for at least having a serious look at the level of fuel reserves.
That's Tony Wood, energy expert at the Grattan Institute.
That may mean it's justified to have a modest increase in the reserves. What we should be doing in addition to that is making sure that we find ways to reduce our dependence on long overseas supply chains of petrol, diesel and aviation fuel, which would mean even if we do continue to have some degree of storage, it wouldn't have to be as much.
He says that should be done by using more biofuels and increasing electrification so there's less reliance on petrol and diesel in the first place.
For example, the EV take-up we've already seen in Australia has reduced our fuel requirements by about 3 days equivalent of storage.
Malcolm Roberts, the boss of the Australian Institute of Petroleum, agrees there needs to be a conversation about the country's fuel reserves, but it's ultimately customers who'll have to bear the cost.
We need to know what additional reserves might cost us, and then we can make a judgment about whether it's worth doing.
The government says bringing back one of the now closed refineries is not realistic because they get dismantled. Tony Wood says there are other fuel security measures the government could look to, though.
They could introduce a new vehicle efficiency standard sort of thing for trucks in the same way we've got one for cars.
Producing low-carbon liquid fuels, although expensive, is an idea Malcolm Roberts also backs exploring.
We have a lot of feedstocks available in Australia, which we can use to produce those fuels. Unfortunately, they'll be expensive. There's opportunities as well to make adjustments to fuel quality standards, then our refineries would be able to produce possibly something like 15-16% more diesel.
Given Australia relies heavily on imported fuel, Foreign Minister Penny Wong is this week travelling through Japan, China and South Korea, countries that together supply us with diesel, petrol and jet fuel.
This is about working hard to ensure that Australia continues to receive the supplies we need.
But it's a two-way street.
We are a reliable supplier of coal, of LNG.
Those LNG exports have been much talked about in recent weeks as the government faces a push to implement a new 25% tax on gas exports.
So no gas tax?
Well, what we're concentrating on here is on supply of fuel.
While he's not saying it publicly, the ABC reported last week the Prime Minister is opposed to such a tax, a relief for the WA Chamber of Minerals and Energy, which will be hosting the Prime Minister for breakfast this morning in Perth.
Evelyn Manfield. Ultramarathon swimmer Andy Donaldson is celebrating a new world record. This time it's for a 55-kilometre swim through the remote Ord River in WA's north. The Scottish-Australian overcame challenging conditions and the prospect of crocodiles to set a new time of 11 hours and 51 minutes. Isabel Masali prepared this report.
As the sun set in WA's East Kimberley, Andy Donaldson swam across the finish line with many of Kununurra's residents cheering him on. And they were ready with the tough questions.
Oh, my gosh.
We were just cheering Andy Donaldson.
Yeah, oh, thank you so much.
Did you see any fish?
Did I see any fish? No, I didn't actually. No.
Did you see any crocodiles?
When you're ready,
just the ones that my coach was wearing on his feet.
The 35-year-old ultramarathon swimmer has just completed the Dam to Dam Challenge, a 55-kilometre swim from the Lake Argyle Dam wall to Kununurra. With a time of 11 hours and 51 minutes, he's the fastest swimmer and the first man to complete it.
Over the past few years, I've been really fortunate to swim in some beautiful places around the world. To be honest, what we have here in Kununurra, swimming down the Ord River past all these just majestic cliffs and all the red rock through the canyons, I think that's probably the best place I've ever swum in my life.
His support crew included two boats and a kayak to help with navigation, hydration and to watch for crocodiles. Though locals say the freshwater crocs are more scared of people.
Before this swim, a lot of people were talking about the crocodiles. A figure of 5,500 got mentioned quite a few times to me, but look, we had a very safe swim out there.
Cheering from the boat was Fremantle open water swimmer Simone Blazer. She completed the challenge in 2024, telling social media followers,
I just had this idea if I could maybe swim the whole thing. It was absolutely amazing. And 16 hours later, I arrived at Swim Beach.
But for Perth-based Andy Donaldson, the adventure was more about the local community.
One of the big ideas behind it was to really engage with the locals and try use the challenge to inspire. And I think people really resonated with that, and it's shown with the support that we saw at the finish line.
Katrina Jowett from the Kununurra Croc Swim Club says it's a special visit because the town's been without a pool since 2024. A new 50-metre pool will open soon.
Without a pool, it's been really tricky, and obviously for a lot of families that's been tricky, not having their children swimming.
We know how important it is through the younger years to really bed down those skills and safety and water awareness. But we're confident as a club. We've got an amazing committee at the moment and we're really excited to see where we go from here. So watch this space. There's exciting things to come.
Katrina Jowett from the local swim club, ending that report by Isabel Musali and Julia Bertolio. And that's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. China buys lots of Iran's oil, but it's trying to keep the war at arm's length. So what role is Beijing playing? How is its economy affected? And what is it learning about the United States military? Today, an expert in China's politics, Neil Thomas, from the Asia Society Policy Institute, on Xi Jinping's strategic moves. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on ABC Listen.